2012, February 14th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 28, The Galilean Moons of Jupiter. So, today, we're going to be continuing our exploration of life in the universe and life in our solar system by... By looking at the beginnings of two fairly unconventional places where we would not have expected life to be found. Today we're going to look at the Galilean moons of Jupiter and find that one of them is going to be the moon Europa. Tomorrow we're going to look at the moons of Saturn. We're going to look at the particular the moon Enceladus and the moon Titan as possible places where life could emerge. So today the lecture's on the moons of Jupiter. Galilean moons of Jupiter are the largest moons around the Jovian system. There's 60-odd moons, but these four are the ones that really call attention to ourselves. They are heated by tides from Jupiter, so they're subject to gravitational tides. That gives them a bit of internal heat that you would not expect for a small body. The closer they are to Jupiter, the greater the heating, and that's going to be important to us in understanding what's going on. The two outermost of the Galilean moons are Ganymede and Callisto. They are old and they are geologically dead. They are basically ice mantles covering rocky cores, but they are cold interiors. They are no longer geologically active. The innermost moons, however, are much more interesting. Io, the innermost of the four Galilean moons, is very strongly tidally heated, so much so that its silicate interior has melted, and it is in fact one of the most volcanically active worlds in the entire solar system. It even beats the Earth for volcanic activity. And finally, Europa is going to really capture our attention. It's intermediate between Io and Ganymede. It is also subject to strong tidal heating. There's some additional effects that come into play here. But what we think is Europa is actually geologically very young. It's an ice ball, but there's very few craters. It's got a geologically young surface. And there are some strong indications that we're going to review that, in fact, it may be liquid water below the ice caps of Europa. If that's true, it makes Europa one of the most promising places outside the Earth where life may have arisen in our solar system. And we'll take a little look at that and see why we begin to think that. Europa is probably going to be more of a focus for looking for life in the solar system than Mars was in the last two decades because of our general realization that liquid water is important and the existence of extremophiles suggests this may be one of the most likely environments for life in the solar system outside the Earth. Just a quick review. The four Galilean satellites of Jupiter are the largest moons of Jupiter. They were discovered in 1610 with Galileo's telescope. They're very large. This montage here shows the four Galilean moons in their order, in order of size, from the largest Ganymede to the smallest Europa. And we put the moon up here for scale. Three of the four moons are bigger than our own moon. So these are objects which are shaped into spherical shapes by their gravity. And they turn out to be mostly rocky ice objects because they're in the outer solar system. Ganymede, at 5,260 kilometers across, is the largest moon in the solar system, followed by Callisto, Io, and Europa. In the order of sizes within the Jovian system. All of these look completely different. They're very different worlds unto themselves. In an Astronomy 161 class, we'd actually spend a fair amount of time on them, but today we're only going to review them because I really want to concentrate on Europa here for pretty much the second half of the class. If you look at them in terms of their orbits going outwards from Jupiter, it's Io, the innermost, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto are the four moons in order. You can remember that order by the acronym, or the mnemonic, I eat green cows. So Io, Europa, Ganymede, Callisto, I eat green cows. Very easy way to remember that. What's important is that these orbits are not just anywhere. First of all, they're not actually circular orbits. They're ever so slightly elliptical, and that's going to be important to us. But also what's important to us is that three of these four moons, their periods are whole number ratios of the other moons. Io, the innermost moon, takes 1.8 days to circle around once around Jupiter. Europa, the second moon out, is 3.6 days, exactly 3.6. It's exactly two times the period of Io. So Io goes around twice every time Europa goes around once. And if that wasn't more, Ganymede, the third one out, is 7.2 days, exactly four times Europa's period. So it goes around, for every time the Ganymede goes around once, Europa goes around twice, Io goes around four times. That means they're constantly lining up on the same part of their orbit in round numbers. Now, where that happens actually slowly moves around because this is a very dynamically complex system. It's one of the rare examples in our solar system of what's called a Laplace resonance. It's a threefold resonance, a 2-to-2-to-1. Ganymede is twice the period of Europa. Europa is twice the period of Io. Callisto, at 16.7 days, breaks the mold. It's actually a step further out. Turns out these orbits are slowly changing. Now, there's various ideas about this. It has to do with the fact that they're exchanging exchanging rotational and orbital energy with Jupiter through the tides of Jupiter's immense gravity. One idea is that these moons are going to be slowly moving out, and eventually they're all going to move out in lockstep in this locked-up resonance, as it's called, and eventually reach the point that the orbit of Ganymede goes around twice for once of Callisto, and then Callisto will get locked in, and all four will move out in lockstep. There's some other people who say that the dynamics are more complex than that when you try to put four bodies in the game, and they don't. The point is that by seeing this resonance, by seeing this whole number ratio, at least between the first three moons, is an indicative of an extremely strong tidal interaction with the planet Jupiter. Jupiter's the largest planet in the solar system. It's got a huge mass, 318 times the mass of the Earth. It raises very strong tides on these moons. Now, we're used to thinking about tides on the Earth as the moon's gravity and the sun's gravity raising tides mostly in the Earth's oceans. We think about the cycle of tides it goes through if we live near the seashore. But in fact, the Earth's body is also distorted by tides from the moon and the sun. It changes shape. It's a little bit flattened. But these body tides are so much smaller than the liquid tides in the ocean, we're not sensible of them in the same way we're sensible of ocean tides. If you live near the seashore, I lived near the seashore for 5 years when I was a student at Santa Cruz, you knew the tide tables pretty well because it told you when you'd go to the beach, whether you'd have surf close or surf far away. With the very strong gravity of Jupiter, with the very close distance involved, and with the effect of these resonances, which allow an extra bit of gravitational forcing in the system, the body tides can be significant, and they actually play a very important role in the internal heating of these worlds. And that's one of the reasons why these are going to be of interest to us in a class on life in the universe. Now, just to put these objects in perspective, this is a plot we've seen a lot. It's our census of the solar system, how far away you are from the sun as a function on the x-axis, and on the y-axis is your mass relative to the mass of the Earth, where 1 is 1 Earth mass. The four Galilean moons lie down here. They're roughly comparable to an order of magnitude to the mass of our moon, the little m here, and the mass of Titan that we're going to meet tomorrow. They're very much smaller than the mass of even the terrestrial planets, but they're a lot bigger than those of the dwarf planets and the asteroids and Kuiper Belt objects. Now remember that we saw, when we talked about the terrestrial planets, the type of atmosphere you have is dependent upon how far away you are from the sun and how big you are. How far away from the sun you are determines the temperature of that atmosphere. A colder atmosphere, it's easier to hold on to light gases. A hotter atmosphere, you lose those gases if your gravity's small. So we could define these gray zones, where above this gray zone, the atmosphere gets so big and so heavy that you begin to accrete hydrogen and you build a big gas giant or ice giant planet. Those are planets which probably are all atmosphere all the way down. So we expect that any object in this big gray band is not a very good place to be looking for life. If you're below the lower gray band, you're so small that you can't hold on to much of an atmosphere of things like carbon dioxide, nitrogen, water vapor, the things that matter to you. So objects below here, like Mercury and the Moon and asteroid Ceres, are expected to be airless. They could not hold on to their atmospheres, and they're small, airless worlds. So you're too small if you're in this gray zone. You're too big if you're here. This sets up a classic Goldilocks problem. The white band here is where you can have some kind of atmosphere. You're either just big enough and just cold enough to hang on to an atmosphere. And you'll notice that the Galilean moons straddle that line. Now, the final piece is they might have atmospheres, but it turns out they don't, or very, very weak ones. The other line here is we saw that the internal heat of a planet, right, is it's formed, it's molten on the inside when it forms and then cools off. The bigger you are, the slower you cool off. And if you're inside this yellow zone, by 4.5 billion years, you should have a cold, dead, solid interior. You shut down geology. And sure enough, Mercury and Mars fall into that zone, as we just got through seeing the last couple days, some of you did, that Mars is cold and dead geologically. But Venus and the Earth are still geologically active. And on the Earth, we have a very active geologic cycle. We have plate tectonics, rebuilding of the atmosphere. Finally, this blue band shows you the zone in our solar system where liquid water is stable on the surfaces of planets with atmospheres in this sort of dark blue box here. So this is kind of the zone within our solar system where we think liquid water can be stably. Mars, as we saw yesterday, just falls outside that box in the present day because its atmosphere is too light, it lost most of its atmosphere, and it's in a place where water is not stable. Water is either vapor or ice. It never lives in a stable liquid state. But Venus and Earth are possible. So looked at from this diagram, I could say, okay, done, class dismissed, because there's nothing of interest to us in the Galilean moons because they're way outside the liquid water zone. They're too small to hang on to much of to have any kind of geologic activity. They're really marginal with regards to hanging on to an atmosphere. Let's take a look at them and see how well that particularly plays out. In particular, let's look at these two big ones, Callisto and Ganymede. They're the highest mass ones. They're the most likely. They're the ones just on the line of holding on to an atmosphere. What are their properties? Well, what we find is, in fact, they have very little atmosphere. They're cold and they're frozen. They basically are mixes of rock and ice. They're relatively low density. And so as a consequence, they're really pretty small worlds. The mean density is about 1.9 to 1.8 grams per cc. As a reminder, liquid water is 1 gram per cc. Pure water ice is about 0.9 grams per cc. That's why ice floats on water. So these are obviously a lot denser than ice. They're not as dense as rock. A reminder, the typical rocks, silicate rocks on the Earth, are about 3 grams per cc in round numbers. So this kind of sits between water and ice, and ice and rock, and so that tells you you're dealing with a rock and ice mix. And we don't really know what the exact interior is like, but we can do some modeling of what they should look like. And so what you expect is kind of a rocky inner core surrounded by a layer of ice. These are bodies which are 5 astronomical units from the sun. They're beyond the so-called frost line in our solar system, where ices can exist in the cold of space, especially water ice. They're not far enough out for methane ice. As you saw in your homework, you have to get pretty far out, past the orbit of Saturn, in order for there to be methane ice in the solar system. But water ice can be water, can be ice, actually roughly inside the asteroid belt and beyond. And so not surprisingly, there can be stable ice on the surfaces, and so you build up in their formation a layer of ice, an accumulation of ice. In fact, the material they formed out of was a mix of rock and ice. We're going to see, now that we're in the outer solar system, rock and ice rather than pure rock, right? Moon is pure rock. The Earth, pure rock, pretty much. These guys, rock and ice. So this is the first example of that. The geology of these surfaces is that they're very old and very heavily cratered. They're absolutely pummeled. They look like the moon if the moon was a kind of icy place with icy craters on it. It's kind of black gunk on their surfaces because they've just been picking up junk forever. Right now, it's kind of snowing. The snow is kind of nice and white and pure. Give a snowfall a couple of days of getting splashed by a COTA bus, it's kind of black and icky. What happens is you get accumulations of dust and dirt and junk on top of snow, and then the snow melts out from underneath it and refreezes at night. And you get this sort of black incrustation underneath relatively pure snow below. That's what happens on these outer moons. That's why they're so dark. They've built up this patina of junk on top of the ice. A few craters have hit, or meteors have hit. They've actually dug down below that patina, brought up fresh ice. So we're pretty sure of what's going on here. But they seem to lack internal heat. They're ancient surfaces. We don't see any sign of geologic repaving. We see cracking and crazing and impacts, but we don't see any young surfaces, albeit young surfaces in ice and rock. So these are geologically dead. They lack sufficient internal heat to melt their interiors because their interiors are not melted. There's no fresh material that can be brought and flowed to the surface to repave. So these are old, cold, and geologically inactive. We don't want to say much about those. Now, just as a review, we talked about the importance of internal heat for determining the habitability or the activity of a planet. And what we saw in the terrestrial planets, you saw this slide a couple days ago, is that in the terrestrial planets, internal heat is determined by the size of the object. The big planets like Earth and Venus have very hot, very molten interiors. The smaller bodies, Mercury, the Moon, and Mars, have solidified all the way through, or mostly solidified all the way through. They're cold and geologically inactive. What determines whether you're old and cold or hot and molten and have an active geology is your size. The bigger the object, the more likely you are to be geologically active. But the Jovian system, it's different. In the Galilean moon system of Jupiter, how much internal heat a moon has doesn't depend on its size. It depends on its proximity to the planet Jupiter. The closer you are to the planet, the stronger the tidal heating, and therefore the greater the internal heating. So innermost Io is smaller than Ganymede, Callisto, and it's about the size of our moon, which is old, cold, and solid throughout, and yet it's the hottest moon in the solar system in terms of its interior because of tidal heating. Outermost Callisto is the coldest interior of these planets, even though it's quite large. It doesn't have any internal heating. The tidal effect is not important. So you get Io here, shown in this beautiful photograph, superimposed against the cloud decks of Jupiter, reminds you how really close Io is to the body of Jupiter. It's really close. It gets a tremendous internal tidal heating, and that's important. How does this tidal heating work? Well, Io's orbit is in this 2-to-1 resonance with Europa. It goes around twice for every time Europa goes around once, which means they always meet up on the same side of the solar system. The way to think about a resonance is, how many of you have done time with small kids pushing them on swings, right? I got nephews. I push my nephews on the swings. If I push in exact time with their swing, so I time my push just when they get to the top of their swing and I give them a push, they get a nice high amplitude and it's a high quality swing experience. If I push on them while they're coming up, I get out of phase of my pushing with their swing. They don't go very high. Uncle Rick sucks at pushing on the swing. Doesn't happen. The same thing happens in gravitational interactions. If you keep lining up, every time a planet comes around, your gravity's force is strongest when you're closest to the other body. If you always meet on exactly the same part of your orbit as you come around, you get this amplification effect. You get what's called a resonance. You actually get a push coming at exactly the same place in your orbital swing around the planet. So that's one of the aspects of it. That orbital push gives you a little bit of a tug. Now, what happens of that is that orbital tug actually pumps up the orbit of Io. And it pumps up the rotation of Io, so that Io is not tidally locked with Jupiter. It's not always showing one face towards Jupiter, like the moon shows only one face towards the Earth. It actually tries to turn through its tidal bulge. So it gets stretched in a direction by the tides of Jupiter, but the fact it's in a resonant keeps pumping it up and keep pumping it into this exaggeratedly elliptical orbit so that Io is trying to turn through its own tidal bulge. And when that happens, it's like taking a tennis ball and squeezing and releasing and squeezing and releasing and squeezing and releasing as you go around. What happens if you do that a lot to a tennis ball? The tennis ball heats up. You get basically what's called tidal friction. You basically sit there and you're squeezing the moon. Io is sitting there getting squeezed and released just like a tennis ball. And as a consequence, it heats up. This rhythmic flexing leads to extremely strong tidal heating. You have a way of getting some of the rotational energy, some of the orbital energy from Jupiter, and you begin to pump it into the interior and you warm up. So these are the effects you get. You get big bulges when you're close, far away, so you change the intensity of that squeezing and you try to turn through your own bulge. All of those things work together to make for intense tidal heating on Io. Europa has something similar happen to it, but because it's further out, it's still in one of these resonances, so it gets this rhythmic flexing, it's not going to be as intense a heating. By the time you get to Callisto, Ganymede and Callisto, they're so far away that the rhythmic heating is insignificant, and they've frozen all the way through. There's another difference between Io and Europa. Their densities are like 3.5 to 3 grams per cc. These are mostly rock. They've got a thin layer of ice on top of Europa and a bit of ice on top of what's mostly a rocky crust on Io. They're much warmer places. They're much heavier. The rock, stressing in the rock, gives you a much greater heating effect. In fact, there's so much heating on Io that the subsurface mantle is molten on the moon Io. It's got a molten mantle underneath a thin crust. It's got a one-piece crust. It's got active volcanism. Io has a fairly more icy, it's lower density. There's a bit more ice in there. This lower density means I expect there to be a subsurface ice mantle on top of a tidally heated interior. It's not clear if the tidal interior is molten or not. It may be molten in pockets. There's not a really good model yet to understand how far down the molten interior of Europa must go. But whatever it is, there's a lot of internal heating, which means what is ice on the surface could be heated enough to be liquid underneath that surface due to the tidal heat coming up from the interior of the moon. Well, for Io, what this means is Io is intensely volcanically active. In fact, it is the most volcanically active world in the entire solar system. There are multiple active volcanoes going off all the time on the surface of this. The deep, molten interior is kept hot by the intense tidal heating. It wells up through cracks in the very thin crust, and there are these black spots that you see all over the place are in fact plumes of material on this airless world coming up and blasting down. It doesn't have an atmosphere or much of an atmosphere because its gravity is so low that it loses any of the gases that come bubbling up from there. The yellow color is because a lot of the material coming up from the interior is rich in sulfur. I remember when we first saw, for hundreds of years, since Galileo discovered them in 1610, the Galilean moons were little points of light. Yeah, with big telescopes, you'd get a little bit of variation. You could tell there were some surface features, but they weren't big surface features like the moon, which has, you know, dark and light with very strong modeling. And Io was always rather mysterious. There were some bits about it that didn't make sense. But when Voyager, in 1979, first traveled past the planet and gave us our first really good look at Io with its cameras, it looked like this. The first color pictures looked like pizza gone bad. Now, I remember seeing this because the local PBS station in Los Angeles was showing a live feed from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena of the various pictures coming down from the Voyager spacecraft. And they ran kind of constantly. They did a morning show. I was a senior in high school. And there was, you know, I tuned it in. I was a geek. What the heck? I watched it. And one morning, the morning that this picture, or picture very much like, this is a Galileo picture, but the first Voyager pictures came down from Io. And we saw this as a completely alien-looking world. I will confess, this is the first and only time I ditched school. I stayed home spellbound watching these pictures come down from Jupiter. It was a real moment of discovery. We knew that the Galilean worlds were no longer points of light. They were individual worlds on their own. And Io was amazing. Here's a passage in 2007, the New Horizons spacecraft, which is on its way out to Pluto, made a gravitational pass by Jupiter. Here's a time-lapsed movie of one of these volcano plumes seen on the limb of Io. To give you an idea of the degree of activity on Io, when New Horizons passed Io, it turned its infrared camera on the nighttime side of Io. All of those bright spots that you see are volcanic hotspots on the surface of this moon. This is one of the most intensely volcanically active places in the entire solar system. It beats everything else hands down. But despite that volcanic activity, it's almost too active. Its surface is unstable. It doesn't contain liquid water anywhere on the surface, maybe a little bit of subsurface stuff, but it's in a very small world. It can't hold on to much of an atmosphere. There's really not much water on the surface of Io. It's really a pretty big molten rock. It's dense. It's volcanically interesting. It's fascinating, but we have to move on. Europa was a surprise. Okay, so Io was brand new, pristine surface, constantly being repaved by volcanism. It's got a huge secondary crust on it. Ganymede and Callisto, ancient, old primary crust, heavily cratered. A little bit of tectonic activity, mostly related to cooling and impacts, but really no activity anywhere recent. They're old and cold worlds. Europa was thought to kind of land in between, and it was expected to be heavily cratered. The first pictures that came back from Europa looked like a billiard ball. It had no features on it at all. They have to crunch the contrast way the heck up with image processing tricks to see any structures at all. It was a surprise. It was geologically young, very young. In fact, it was known to be fairly bright and shiny beforehand from telescopic observations, so they expected some ice. But that ice should be dirty over time, and a lot of the ice is, in fact, bright and shiny. That means it's fresh ice. The old ice on Ganymede and Callisto is 3 billion years old. It's covered over in gunk. It hasn't been re-iced in years. This thing has been repaved constantly by liquid water welling up from the inside. There's very few impact craters, which means it's a very young surface. This crust has been repeated over and over again. The repaving is not volcanism as we understand it. It's not rock, molten rock volcanism. It's water geysering. It's kind of a water volcanism in which the water geysers up through cracks in the surface. The cracks are put in there because you're stressing the ice as you squeeze and compress the planet tidally. The rock, the ice breaks. Liquid water from the inside wells up through the cracks, flows out over the surface, then is exposed to the cold of space and freezes. So it's a kind of volcanism, but it's a water ice volcanism. We're going to see this elsewhere in the outer solar system. It's a weird kind of geology. Now, this ice surface is fractured, but when the Galileo spacecraft was sent many years later after Voyager and actually orbited Jupiter and made many close passes on Europa, what we found is that this surface, which was relatively smooth except for these funky dark grooves, in fact is fractured into ice rafts and flows. Only a few kilometers across, we could see the tremendous activity on the surface of this world. Here's a close-up. Here's one of the close-up pictures of Europa taken from the Galileo spacecraft. This is a region only 26 miles across. I know I should use kilometers, but that's what the picture got, so I'll just live with that. And you see all these sort of blocks in between, ice in between, but very few impact. In fact, there's virtually no impact craters. A little couple things. Jupiter's gravity tends to attract rocks and ice balls and bits of comets, so you get some impacts. But compared to Galileo or Callisto, where all of the terrain features you see are impact craters, and then you see this, and you say, have I seen that somewhere before? And the answer is, yes, you have. That's the Arctic Ocean of the Earth. The scales are a little bit smaller. Here's a, for scale here, here's an insane paraglider. But you see these cracks and flows and linear features. Again, flows, cracks, long linear features. These are not just by analogy. We are seeing water ice, we don't know how thick, but water ice floating on top of a liquid water underpinning. Now, there may be ways to get around. Maybe it's not a perfect liquid. Maybe it's kind of a slushy mix, kind of like a slurry of water ice and other stuff. But this is what the surface of Europa reminds us of immediately. And under the Arctic Ocean is, in fact, one of the Earth's liquid water oceans. And under that ocean, there's a tremendous amount of marine life. So this is what gets people so excited about Europa. It's close enough to Jupiter to be tidally heated. That tidal heating takes what should have been a solid ice layer on the surface, and it should be sufficient to melt that ice underneath the surface into water. Once you get to the surface, Europa has no atmosphere, or only a very, very thin, tenuous atmosphere, because its gravity is really low. It's below the line where it can retain an atmosphere on our diagram. So when that water ice hits the surface, liquid water at low pressure flashes immediately into a solid. If sunlight falls upon that water ice, it will flash off and sublimate into a vapor. This is a very low pressure world and very cold. But below that ice, where the pressure, where the weight of the ice pushing down from above and the heat, tidal heat of the world coming up from below, you can expect the possibility of a layer which might be actually liquid. But is it liquid? There's two different schools of thought. So there's internal tidal heating, there's ice on the surface. We see signs of geological activity, of liquid water coming from the interior. We see these chaotic structures are all suggestive of this liquid water. We also see some other lines of evidence. Okay, the geologic activity we've already covered. The other surprise around Europa was the instruments on the spacecraft as it flew by detected a weak magnetic field. Geologically dead worlds don't have solid interiors. They don't have the dynamo activity in liquid metal to make magnetic fields like the Earth does. Mars, for example, lacks a magnetic field because its metallic interior is completely solidified. Well, we can make a dynamo with metals, but water, if you add a little bit of salts, dissolved minerals, salt water is electrically conductive. Very weakly, it's not the same way as metal. And if you get circulational motions in a slightly salty liquid water, you will make a kind of weak dynamo, and you will make a weak magnetic field. So you need a weakly electrically conductive material that's got currents flowing, that's got literal flows. And one way you can get those flows is if you've got a warm bottom and a cold top, you literally set up these upwellings and downwellings kind of like a slow boil. It's not boiling, but it's kind of like a slow simmer. And that, but it has to be salty, because pure water is not a strong electrical conductor. You have to put impurities in it, and the best impurities are dissolved mineral salts. That could be the source of this unusually strong magnetic field. We expected none, so any magnetic field is strong, meaning unusual. Furthermore, if you then do the calculations, and these are hard calculations because we don't know the details of the inside of the planet like we do the Earth. We haven't put seismographs on the surface and probed it in any way. But if you take the best ideas of what the interior of Europa should look like, and you estimate how much heating should come from the squeezing and release of the tidal field of Jupiter and the resonant interactions with Io on the inside and Ganymede on the outside, the calculations suggest that the heat should be sufficient to melt the subsurface ice and keep it liquid. Now, there's some alternative pictures of this, and one is that it actually isn't liquid. You couldn't swim through it, but it's kind of a water-ice slush mix. For example, walk outside today and look at the little piles of water-ice slush, right? Because we're right on the boundary between being frozen and not. It's right around the freezing point today. What happens? You get a little bit of liquid, you get a little bit of ice. They're kind of in that suspended zone between, and they form slushy. So it could, in fact, be that the interior of Europa underneath the ice isn't flat, the solar system's biggest slushy, or one of the biggest slushies. And slushy ice can flow. You can get flows of slushy bits. Go step on a slush ball out there. What does it do? It flows out between your shoes. So slushy ices can, in fact, set up the kinds of circulation currents that can give you a weak magnetic field. So there are alternative interpretations. We do not know for 100% certainty it's a clear liquid ocean below the ice. There are other possibilities, but this is what everyone's betting on because all the evidence seems to point in that direction, especially the geysering. So how are we going to actually settle these questions? Well, one of the ways we can settle this question is we can go back to Europa. Now that we know from the Galileo mission, which was the last major orbital mission around the planet Jupiter, we got something to look at. And what we got to look at is Europa. Europa is going to be a subject of intensive study. There's currently a series of concepts, a joint U.S., European, Japanese, Russian, and perhaps even Chinese will join in on us at some point, of a mission to send a series of spacecraft to Jupiter, among other things, to orbit and lock into orbit around Europa. One of those missions carries a very large ice-penetrating radar array with it. Its purpose will be to actually try to sound with radar through the ice layers to see what's down in the interior. We've tested these technologies by sounding the interior of the Antarctic ice cap, which can be 3-4 miles thick in places. And what we find when we do that, and there's other ways to do this, that below the ice, even 2 miles below the ice of the Antarctic, there are standing water lakes. Lake Vostok is one of them. We'll say something about that in a second, but there are many more of these so-called subglacial lakes. So that it is possible for liquid water to exist in an ice place in the Antarctic where you have the pressure of the weight of all the ice above you pressing down and the heat of the Earth coming up can melt the water to make a subglacial lake. We find these by using ice-penetrating and ground-penetrating radar technologies. So we want to build those same kind of technologies and send them to Europa. And there's a couple of different concepts for that. The real gutsy thing, though, is once you find out if there is liquid water below, you want to drill through it into the liquid layers. And this is one concept showed here called the cryobot. Cryo is, of course, the word for ice. The idea is it's a thermal probe that will go through however many kilometers of ice. A hatch opens up, and a little submersible robot comes out and explores whatever's below that ice layer. Can actually travel around and look at what's underneath the layers here. This is a geologically active world. There could be hot vents of places where the crust is breaking through, where you're bringing up weak magma from the deep rocky interior. We know there's a significant rocky interior on this because its density is high. It's 3 grams per cc. This is not an ice ball like the outer moons. We know on Earth that life probably got its start near deep hydrothermal vents in the ocean. Why do these things interest us? For that very reason. This is highly speculative, so is this. But it's where we're going. It's where we're going to try to push the next levels of exploration, and here's why. Remember, we looked at the Earth and we looked at extremophiles. The first place that life probably arose on our planet was deep in the ocean near these hydrothermal vents. Okay? Why is that? Because they have some of the major prerequisites we've seen as the requirements for life. You have a source of heat. We've been very provincial in our view of the source of heat being sunlight, but extremophiles have taught us there exists life where there's no sun on the Earth. Where does that heat come from? The interior of the Earth. So too, there's interior of Europa is heated by Jupiter tides. If it's really warm and it's geologically young, we know it's warm today, we have a source of heat. Number two, we know a requirement for life is liquid water. Well, we've just seen the signs of the possibility of liquid water on Europa, beneath the ice. You don't have surface water on this world. It's airless. Surface water is not stable. But when you take the pressure of all of Europa's ice cap from above and the heat welling up from below, you set up the conditions for stable, standing liquid water. It's probably salty water. The reason for the saltiness probably is telling you there's dissolved minerals in it. Why? The magnetic field of Europa. We also suspect that that would harbor complex organics. We're going to see an example tomorrow of where complex organics have actually been seen. And the ice and the water combined, because Europa lacks an atmosphere, shields it from the harsh ultraviolet radiation of the sun, which would hopelessly sterilize anything on the surface. We have energy. We have liquid water. We have complex organics and carbon compounds common in this place, which means we have a source of food. And we have shielding from harsh ultraviolet radiation. We have all the prerequisites that when these conditions occurred on our Earth, life appeared within 100 million years of the stabilization of our surface at the end of the epoch of last heavy bombardment. If we wanted to look anywhere in our solar system for a place where life arose, it's Europa. Now, we might expect that what we're going to find is anaerobic life. We're not going to expect complex life, maybe. It's probably going to be like what we find near the deep ocean vents, probably mostly microbiological. How can we begin to test some of these technologies out? We're already doing it. There's one place we can look on the Earth to test the idea of could life arise underneath an immense ice cap in liquid water. And that's down in the Antarctic. A couple of days ago, a Russian team, which has been working for 20 years off and on, managed to finally get a drill to penetrate 2 miles down into glacial Lake Vostok. This is a radar image, ice-penetrating radar, down through this very large lake. It's the largest of the subglacial lakes of the Antarctic. Vostok is the Russian station. It's one of the coldest places on the Earth. Wintertime temperatures can get below minus 100 degrees Celsius. This is a brutal environment. During the very brief summer season, which goes on during our winter, they've drilled down 3,600 meters. And they've now made their way down. Just the other day, they punched through to the bottom layer off of the bottom 200 meters of accreted ice, and they've now confirmed they've reached liquid water down at the bottom of Lake Vostok. It's taken them years to drill down through here. The problem was the hole used to like to close up. They used to fill the hole with a substance that would not freeze at minus 100 degrees Celsius, kerosene. So the big challenge was in that last step, the Russians they have different standards of cleanliness in their drilling work than the Brits and the Americans. And everyone started freaking out. Hey, guys, you don't want to punch through and dump all the kerosene and well crap into this water, which has not seen the surface in more than 2 million years. So they've gone through and used a hot ice drill core. They've set up ice caps above. We've heard about caps and wells before, so some of us are holding our breath. If they can keep the junk out of the well, they've penetrated with the hot ice drill. The next steps, which are, unfortunately, they just made it through before the season ended, so it's going to be many years before this goes on. The next steps are going to be now to penetrate down into the lake and begin to sample the water and look for microbiological life. They have found bacteria and fossils down here in the accreted ice layer above the lake. We don't know what's in the lake. It's going to get real interesting here in a few years. Is it sterile, or has there life been there? This is life that has been cut off from the surface for millions of years. It really is a land time may have forgotten. It may be a separate little pocket of evolution. What's down there? We don't know. But the technologies that we will develop to look down there is what we're going to bring to Europa someday to plumb between, below the ice. Here is, warning, blatant speculation. What will we find on Europa? This has excited people's attention more than anything else. I didn't put this in your notes because it's blatant speculation. The surface, bad place. Sunshine, harsh ultraviolet radiation. Jupiter's magnetosphere is a source of really high energy particles. It's a radiation nasty place. The surface is sterile to a depth of about 10 centimeters, about that much. That's basically a dead zone for radiation. A few meters down through the ice, sunlight no longer penetrates. It's no longer a place of ice. Down below that is a land of darkness. It goes down to many kilometers down to what we think is the bottom of the ice cap. If this is an ocean reservoir, if it contains the organics and the salts we think are there, if it contains the heat and the vents from the upper inner volcanism of Europa, and we have an idea the volcanism could exist because its nearest neighbor Io is volcanically active, although in a more intense way. Who knows what could form? What kinds of life could form? Is it simply little tiny bacteria-like things, single-celled organisms? Europa's been like this for billions of years. It's had billions of years. If life got started on Europa, could it evolve in the direction of complex forms of life? And, of course, there's tons of speculation as to what they might be. The cartoonists have kind of gone nuts here. But this is real. This is a real possibility. If there is life elsewhere in the solar system, I'm willing to put my money down. It probably exists underneath the ices of Europa, if it's going to be anywhere. It's starting to focus the attention of people on this planet. How do we do that? The drilling of the Lake Vostok is just the start of an effort. I don't know if I'm going to live to this, whether you will live to see this or your children will live to see it, but someday we're going to have the answer to the question, what lies beneath the ice of Europa? Is it another place where life has managed to get a foothold in our solar system? Any questions? Okay, see you all tomorrow.